So let us continue. And somebody has left here. Did you do this? Yeah, okay, so do I. That makes sense. Okay. So there's somebody actually left a translation here. Yesterday we had a look at the idea of a sense restraint, right? We had that paragraph, seeing a form with your eye and all that stuff. And here is a translation of Bhaktisiddhanta's translation here. And it's very similar to what I was suggesting yesterday, which is quite nice. So what he has here is that when they see a sight with their eyes, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of sight was left unrestrained, bad, unwholesome qualities of desire and aversion, right? Exactly the same, would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of sight and achieving its restraint. That's really nice. I had no idea what the translation was, so that's kind of purely coincidence. Well, maybe not pure coincidence, but we know each other very well, so that's probably one of the reasons. So anyway, so that's always nice to know that you are thinking along the same lines, which is useful. Okay, anyway, let's move on, continue on the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, the two kinds of thoughts. So we have been, this is all now about right effort on the path, so the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And this is how to deal with the thinking mind, right? So this is a very, very useful, I think, the kind of advice that we find in this sort of sutta. And we just looked at how the Buddha is talking about how he practiced before his awakening. He called himself a Bodhisattva. And we have a look at the meaning of that from the viewpoint of the early suttas. And then we have this passage that comes afterwards where the Buddha says, suppose I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desires, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty, as here, we'll talk about that in a second. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, thoughts of non-cruelty. And then he has this, after that, I'm going to read the first few words of the next sentence. It says, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. Yeah, so I'll stop there. So first of all, this last few words there, the reason I read them out is because it relates back to what we have just read, the two kinds of thought. As I abided thus, in other words, as I was dividing my thoughts into two classes, yeah, it refers back to that. And he qualifies that as abiding diligent. Diligent here, the Pali word is appamada. And we discussed this word before, and it really means more like being heedful or careful or circumspect, or, you know, you investigate properly before you do something. This is the idea of appamada. Diligent in English usually means that you work really hard, you're diligent, you do all your duties. That is kind of slightly missing the point. It's not just doing lots of stuff, it's how you do it. It's that you have put care into it. You are, you know, you... you're circumspect, not all of these kind of things. That is what really matters with the idea of appamada. It gives quite a different feeling to it, in my opinion, than the word diligent. Ardent, this is also quite a strange English word. The Pali word is atapi, and atapi usually just means that you are energetic in what you're doing. Yeah, you have energy. And this is really kind of what comes from this. The word ardent is not something that anyone would really use these days. And the word resolute is paditatta in Pali. And it actually relates directly to the word padana. Padana, samma padana. Right effort is the Pali word for right effort in the Noble Eightfold Path. So in other words, this kind of relates directly to the idea of right effort. Yeah, paditatta, you're putting forward the right kind of effort. So here we have someone who is energetic, yeah, they are putting forth effort, and they are careful in what they are doing. Yeah. And what is it that they're doing? What does this effort actually mean? This is Pahipatta relating straight back to the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Well, what they are doing is this thing we've just been looking at, dividing your thinking into two classes. That is what right effort means in this context. Yeah, so this is... So you, the point, of course, with that is that the kind of effort that we're talking about here is not really an effort that has anything to do with willpower. Yeah, dividing your thinking into two classes, that is all about being wise. It's all about being apamada, being circumspect, being careful. That is what this refers to. And this already begins to show you, just like the previous sutta I was reading out, that effort in Pali, restraint, all these words that seem to imply some degree of willpower, some degree of agency on our part. Actually, very often on the Buddhist path, they refer much more to the idea of using wisdom power, using wisdom to guide ourselves in the right way. And that is quite a significant difference. And not only is it significant in the sense that it kind of feels, it's a very different way of looking at things, but actually it's also significant in the way that wisdom power, when you use wisdom in the right way, it's far more powerful in achieving the purpose that we're trying to achieve than using willpower. Willpower is actually very feeble. Human willpower, notoriously fickle, notoriously difficult to kind of sustain, all these kind of things. Whereas wisdom power actually is really powerful and does make a massive difference in our outlook, in our mind, all these kind of things when we apply it in the right way. So this is already, I don't know about you, but I find this kind of stuff really exciting, right, and really interesting. Here you almost have a definition where effort actually refers to wisdom. So it's a very different way of looking at things than how most people will regard this. So the effort here then is to divide your thoughts into two classes. So on the one hand, he sets all the thoughts that are defiled in one way or another, thoughts that are kind of leading in the wrong direction or whatever. And on the other hand, he puts all the thoughts that are pure, that leads you in the right direction, that leads you in the right way on the Noble Eightfold Path. And that may seem simple, it may seem fairly straightforward, and sometimes it is straightforward because sometimes our thoughts are very strong, they're very strong emotions, and we know that there is defilement there, or we know that they are pure or whatever because of the power of the thoughts. But sometimes this is quite difficult. Because sometimes the thoughts are very subtle. We sit in our meditation, we can't get any further. There's no real hindrances there. We can't really see any desire. There's no ill will. It just kind of doesn't go anywhere. We're kind of sitting there watching the breath. Nothing is happening here. So why is it stopping us? And this is the kind of thing we mean here when the Buddha talks about being able to divide his thoughts. He means also the very subtle aspects of our thinking mind. All the little things that kind of are hindrances and block us from making progress. This is what I mean by the Buddha being very understated. He just says, I divide my thoughts into two classes. But actually, there's a lot of meaning in that. And the idea is a complete division of all thoughts, regardless of their subtlety and their fine qualities. All of that is included there. So this actually is quite difficult. And a large part of the Buddhist path is precisely about being able to understand which thoughts are wholesome, what mind states are wholesome, what perceptions are wholesome, and also the corresponding unwholesome aspects of these things. And this is what, just to kind of repeat that, this is what Satipatthana in the large part is about. It's actually specifically said in the Satipatthana Sutta that this is what you do. This is what the Dhammavicaya, Sambuddhanga, the awakening factor of investigation, of quality, is all about. We had a look at those things before. It's all about understanding the mind, understanding the various qualities, which ones are useful, which ones are bad. And it takes a lot of investigations because there is a lot of subtlety in this. Let's have a quick look at these various qualities and what they actually refer to. So sensual desire here is the karma of karma chanda, what is it in this case? I think it's karma chanda in this case. So this refers to any kind of desire that arises through the five senses. And this can, of course, be very subtle. It can include any kind of attachment that you have to the, even attachment to the senses is included in this. So if you can't let go of your senses in meditation, you're trying to kind of let go of things, but you have some degree of attachment just to the ability to see. Just the attachment to the ability to see is actually a kind of sensual desire from the Buddhist point of view. So if you can't let go of the sight altogether, it means it's going to hinder you in your meditation practice. So this is the kind of thing we're talking about here on the very subtle level. You can't get rid of your body because you want to be able to feel things. Yeah, same kind of thing. You can't let go of your body, so you can't go deeper in meditation. These are the things that are included in this. Ill will. Again, these things can also be subtle sometimes. Subtle little negativities. If the ill will is completely gone, usually you have friendliness towards everybody. You feel kind of, your heart kind of opens up and all of that kind of disappears. And the last one here is thoughts of cruelty. And this is vihinsa or hinsa in Pali. This is exactly the same word that was used by Mahatma Gandhi. Mahatma Gandhi had the Ahimsa movement, And Ahimsa was the non-violent kind of, the non-violent rebellion against the British rule in India at that time. And that was Ahimsa. That was exactly the same idea, non-violence, non-harming. And it doesn't really mean non-cruelty. What it means is more like the idea of being inconsiderate, being cold-hearted, being callous, being ruthless, not caring for the consequences of your action, right? If you are a ruthless business person, and you say, my business is all that matters, what happens to other beings around me is kind of irrelevant as long as my business succeeds. And then you have all these casualties that kind of, drop by on the way to kind of success in your business. Or you walk down the path and you see all these ants in the path and you say, I don't care about ants. Ants are irrelevant in this world. And it's not that you want them to die, it's just that you don't care about them. You're cold, right? You have a cold kind of heart towards these little creatures. Or you see a mosquito on your arm. Mosquitoes don't, well, actually that's a bit of ill will probably there if you kill the mosquito. So basically it's not ill will, but it's a lack of care about, other beings basically. And you don't care about the consequences of your actions and how they affect other beings. So it is the opposite of compassion. Ill will is metta, because ill will, you are seeing the negative qualities in other people or beings. With metta, you're seeing the good qualities. Here with vihinsa, you are being cold-hearted, and the opposite of that is being like warm-hearted, having compassion. That is the opposite of that. So you can see the opposites here. So ruthless, I like ruthless, it actually is an ancient English word. When I was looking this up, I figured this out. There's an ancient English word called ruthful. Ruthful. Have you heard about ruthful before? It was used back in the 18th century, apparently, about 200 years ago. So if you haven't heard of it, it wouldn't be so strange. But the idea of Ruth, Ruth is a very common word. You have it in Germany, right? The name Ruth, it's a woman's name, So Ruth means compassion, actually. That's the meaning of the word Ruth. So if you are ruthless, no compassion. If you are ruthful, you're full of compassion. These are these words. So maybe we should bring this word back into the English language and we can translate this word as ruthful. Just to make it really obscure, so make absolutely sure nobody understands what's going on. So that is the idea of these bad thoughts. And then, of course, on the other side, you have the thoughts of renunciation, which means giving up sensual desire. And what it really means, it means giving up attachment in that area. It doesn't mean that you kind of stop enjoying yourself in the world at all. What is interesting when you read the suttas, when you read how, arahants or people who are practicing the path a long way down the track, who have, access to deep samadhi and jhanas and all these kind of things, it specifically says that these people, they have even more greater appreciation of the sensual pleasures. When they eat food, you get very simple food in your arms for them, and it feels like a royal meal, it feels really nice, because your senses are so acute. And precisely because you have no craving and you have no attachment to it, that is not in the way to distort your appreciation of the food. Craving is always about the future. You're never able to stay in the present moment. You can't appreciate what you have right now fully. But when that is gone, you can actually appreciate it more. So it's weird, right? You let go of kind of your attachment to sensual pleasures, and you actually appreciate those pleasures more. But you're not attached to them because you know something higher, something better. So that is what it's like, if you kind of, if you like your, nice homemade meals, you're not attached to McDonald's anymore, because you think McDonald's is kind of, you know, not the same quality here. I mean, maybe that's not what you think, I don't know, but that's a possibility here. So you kind of, you change, you move to a higher level here, and so you abandon the lower happiness as a consequence. So that is really what it means. It doesn't mean that you chuck out all the sensual pleasures. It just means that you see them in context. And when you see them in context, you abandon your attachment to these things. And that is why when you sit down to meditate, you can let go. Let go of seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, all of that. You're able to let go of that. And for that reason, you're able to go inside and achieve the deeper state of internal peace as a consequence. So it's important to understand these things in the right way. It's always this idea of sensual desire and sensual pleasures is something that people often feel kind of a bit stumped by. They're not really sure how to deal with that. But that is just giving you some information, some background to that. So that is the thought of renouncing these things. It means that you give up the attachment to them. Thoughts of non-ill will largely means thoughts of metta. It's a bit broader than that, because metta is just about friendliness and kindness to other people, right? But non-ill will can also mean other thoughts that have to do with not being ill will. Things like upeka, the other four brahma-viharas, right? So they kind of very much more broadly any kind of positive mind state which is opposed to ill will. Upeka would also be one of those. Upeka meaning like equanimity or even-mindedness. And the last one being the abhinsa, which basically is compassion, but again, it's probably a little bit broader than compassion and includes other aspects as well. So that's it. That's the kind of how we divide the world into two classes, of thought. And so that is the beginning. And only then, really, once you understand what the thoughts are bad and what thoughts are good, only then can you actually deal with them in the right way, because you have to know what's going on before you can actually deal with these things. And this is the next part here, is how to deal with these thoughts. And this is what the Buddha said. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So this passage shows us how to deal with thoughts that aren't really, that we don't want to have, right? In this particular case, it talks about sensual desire, and I wouldn't really recommend you to focus so much on that. I would recommend you to focus much more on ill will, for the reason that ill will is actually much easier to deal with, because it is more painful and it's more obvious what we have to do when it comes to ill will, whereas sensual desire is actually quite hard. As a monastic, I think dealing with sensual desire is probably more important, but even for monastics, I think dealing with ill will is really number one priority. So it's easier to deal with, and also ill will is more, basically it's worse. It deals to more bad, leads to more bad karma, it leads to more problems in life, and all of these kinds of things. So it's both worse in terms of blocking us in progress on the path, and also it's easy to deal with, which means that every reason to focus mostly on the idea of ill will. I'm also going to look a little bit later on at sensual desires and how to deal with that, but I'm not going to focus so much on that. Mostly look at the more negative qualities. So this is how you deal with it. And of course, what is so interesting about this, when you read this, is that there is nothing here about willpower. You have these bad thoughts. It doesn't say kind of you kind of force them out of your mind and you kind of crush them out and use willpower. What it says is that you use understanding. Yeah, you understand. This leads to my own affliction. In other words, you use wisdom power to understand what is going on. And that is actually the way of overcoming these negative qualities. So the whole progress here, the whole abandoning of these things, is about using wisdom. And that, of course, ties in very nicely with what we saw in the previous sutta. The previous sutta was talking about using the power of reflection. So you reflect in the right way. And, of course, that's just an alternative way of saying using wisdom. Yeah, you reflect rightly. And the outcome is you abandon those negative qualities. So this is just an elaboration on that, really. So it starts off, the Buddha says, the thought of sensual desire arose in me. Yeah, so this is the first thing. That already is quite interesting because, as I was mentioning yesterday, here the Buddha is having exactly the same kind of defilement that all the rest of us have. So when you have a thought of sensual desire arise in you, you are in good company. Yeah, you don't have to feel so bad about it. You don't have to feel terrible. Later on, it talks about ill will. The Buddha knows, the Buddha to me knows, I had a thought of ill will arise in me. Again, you are in really good company when these things happen. So remember that. And you don't have to be so harsh on yourself. Oh no, I should be a good Buddhist. I shouldn't have ill will. Of course you're going to have an ill will. It's just unavoidable. So don't be too idealistic about this and see that you are, this is just part of the human condition to have these problems. And once you know the Buddha had the same problems, wow, it actually makes it so much more, so much easier to accept these things in yourself. So this is the first thing. And then he says the next thing is, I understood this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. And this points back to the thing I was talking about just before, about dividing your thoughts into two classes. To understand every time a thought of sensual desire arises in you takes a lot of insight, because you have to know the qualities of your mind in great detail to be able to do that. It sounds like an innocuous little statement, but actually it is quite profound because of the wide variety, again, of these kind of thoughts. So this is the first thing. You have to understand the existence of these things. And this is where investigation, mindfulness, satipatthana, dhammavicaya, investigation of qualities, all of these things come into their right. Once you know it has arisen, then you deal with it, right? And then the way he deals with it is thinking as follows. This leads to my own affliction, to the affliction of others, to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. Yeah, that's enough. All you have to do is to remember that these things are problematic. They lead to affliction. They lead to suffering. They lead to problems. That is enough. If you fully understand, and this is kind of the point here, if you fully understand that something is problematic, then, of course, your mind turns away from that. So the trick here, and this is kind of a hard trick, and the trick here is to actually understand that these qualities are actually harmful. And in the long run, they lead down the wrong track, and they lead to all kind of problems for yourself. And when you understand that, then the mind turns away all on its own. There's nothing you have to do. You don't have to use any willpower to turn the mind away. It turns away because it knows that is the wrong place to go. I was using the simile of the hot plate the other day, right? You walk around the house, somebody has turned on the hot plate, you have no idea that actually happened. By accident, you put your hand in, you take it away straight away. You don't have to think, should I take my hand away? That's too late already, you just have to think about it. It's an automatic reaction. There's an automatic withdrawal of the hand. It's like a reflex. In exactly the same way, when your mind fully comprehends that there is a problem somewhere, and something actually is painful, there's a reflex in the mind that draws it away from that thing in exactly the same way. You are using wisdom power, and the consequence of that wisdom power is an automatic reaction in the mind, withdrawing from those negative qualities. Yeah, so it's incredibly powerful. It's really, really powerful stuff. Instead of trying to suppress it and hold it down and using willpower or whatever, there's kind of this complete withdrawal of what is going on in this way. So how do we do that? How do we do that in terms of sensual pleasures? How can we actually think about them in such a way that the mind withdraws in this way? And there's a number of things. I will talk about this a little bit more later, but maybe just to give you some preview of what that is going to be about. So one of the things about sensual desire that once you start to look at it carefully is that you realize it. As I was saying the other day, that it always involves craving and desire. And if you look at craving and desire, you feel what it feels like. It feels like an agitation. It is restless. Yeah, it is never peaceful. The Buddha compares it to a fire, and a fire has this kind of restlessness about it. It's also hot at the same time. Yeah, it's a bit like that. And the more you understand that craving has this restlessness, this agitation about it, this lack of peace, it's actually unpleasant when you know it properly. Yeah. That, of course, is one of the things that move you away from this. On the more another aspect of this idea of sensual pleasure, it always leads to attachment to things. Yeah, if you find pleasure in something, yeah, eventually you get attached to those things that give rise to pleasure. That's why we get attached to people sometimes. There's different kinds of pleasure. One is the kind of the pleasure with a partner, the pleasure with family members, and all of these kind of things. It is within that same kind of realm in some way. So we attach to these things. And when you're attached to them, you're asking for suffering in the future. Because you know you can't hold on to these things. These things have a life of their own, quite literally when it comes to people, but in all circumstances. And eventually they will pass away. They will be taken from you. Nature will come and reclaim its own territory, so to speak. And people will die. Objects will disappear and get lost. And because you are attached, it will be difficult. So attachment is like saying, please, allow me to suffer. That's what you do when you're attaching it. So this is what you see, right? What you see as well is that you start to see that sensual pleasure, this is kind of the deeper sense of it, it binds you to samsaric existence. Of all the ties that bind us to samsara, the most powerful one is probably sensual pleasures. Yes, there is a desire for existence which is more profound in many ways. The sensual pleasures is like a really big obstacle that we have to overcome, and then the smaller obstacles kind of get overcome afterwards. It's a very strong bond that binds us to existence. Always being pulled by the nose, by craving, moving on to something else, never resting it. Always thinking we're going to find a solution to the problem by looking in the wrong place. Never being satisfied. Being tied to this wheel of birth and death is really what this is, what this does. And that, after a while, becomes kind of scary. Yeah, every time I indulge in essential pleasures, I'm kind of, tying another knot of the cord that binds me to samsara. And it's even more difficult to undo later on because of that. And you think, well, this is madness, you think, after a while. And then just, instead of tying knots, you start untying knots instead. So this is how you reflect, right? That this leads to my affliction. It leads to my suffering, to my problems. And when you do this, remember, these things are things you have to build up. It is not easy to think these things, especially when it comes to sensual pleasures. And again, I shouldn't focus too much on this, because this is not the main problem, I think. But it's things that you have to build up. You have to reflect on them. You have to read the suttas. Try to understand what is going on. And as you do that, eventually the insight gradually arises. The understanding gradually arises. And then this becomes a power in your mind, whereby you can turn away, bang, like that, really fast. And look in a different direction, and then the sensual desire, the attachment kind of evaporates right on the spot. Then you have the same thought in regard to others, right? To other people. It's always interesting how in the suttas you start with yourself. Very different from kind of Christianity, where you're not supposed to think about yourself too much. In Buddha, yourself is first. It's kind of a different way, different attitude to things. But then, secondly, it comes an attitude to others. Yeah, so if we know that it leads to other people suffering, then that, of course, is also a bad consequence. So whenever we are attached to sensual objects in the world, other people will suffer as a consequence. Why is that? Well, because often we compete over the same things, and we compete over things in the world, especially things like partners in life, right? So we compete over things. Also, when we are attached to somebody or attached to something, we have a vested interest. We start to control them because it is about us rather than about them. Yeah, so many of these little things that actually lead not only to your own suffering, but to suffering of others as well. So if you have a sense of compassion for others, if you want to minimize the suffering of other people in this world, again, it is the right thing to do, is to reduce these qualities. The last one is that it is affliction for both. So it's not as if you can, you know, I will be the martyr and I'm going to kind of, I will help other people, but I will suffer. Actually, this thing is a problem for both you and others. And this is kind of the final point here. And then we have these other qualities here that the Buddha uses to overcome this. It obstructs wisdom. Panya nirodhika is the Pali word. It literally makes wisdom cease. Yeah, and I don't know what you think, but to me, wisdom is like one of the most beautiful aspects of the development of the path, to become wise, to see things clearly, to understand the distinction between happiness and suffering. Wisdom is the highest of the spiritual faculties. It's the one which holds everything else together on the Buddhist path, the most beautiful of all the faculties. From wisdom, everything else happens as a consequence. All positivity, everything good in the world, comes from the idea of wisdom. So if it makes wisdom cease, it's really bad news, right? It could get much worse than that. So for that reason, if you understand that it actually makes wisdom cease, then, of course, it becomes something very negative, and you just move away from that because you want to be wise. Why does it make wisdom cease? Well, because if you have a desire into something, you have a vested interest in that object of the desire. When you have a vested interest, it means you can't see it neutrally. This is the exact opposite of vested interest and seeing things neutrally. You can't just look on and understand it for what it is, because you have an attachment. You have some degree of something you want to get out of that object, and that is the problem there. So every time these desires arise, you know and you can feel that for yourself that your mind is actually distorted. It is not seeing things in the right way. This is one of the reasons why I suggested yesterday, if you want to make a decisions in life, decisions should always be made when your mind is peaceful, calm, there is hardly any desires and craving attachments there. There is no ill will, none of these negative qualities. And when your mind is peaceful and calm, then you can check it out. Sometimes during your meditation, perhaps during this retreat, you feel particularly peaceful. And that is often the time to make a decision. Right? I'm not saying you should make decisions at that time because that will interrupt your meditation, but you do that and afterwards you have some clarity here, and suddenly you will realize problems that you had for a long time, suddenly the solution just comes to you. It kind of comes out of nowhere. You don't know where it comes from because you haven't been thinking about it. In fact, it's precisely because you haven't been thinking about it that the solution often comes. Bang, there it is. Okay, where did it come from? Don't know, it doesn't matter, but there it is. It came because the hindrances were low. Yeah, that is when the mind has clarity. That's when you can see things in the right way. That is what wisdom is all about. That's what vipassana is all about. All of these kind of things. So to me, that is terrible. When I hear something obstructs wisdom, I think, gee, I really don't want to go there. That is bad news. And on top of that, it causes difficulties. So this is like problems in life, and it leads away from Nibbana. So, I don't know if you have any sense of what Nibbana is, whether you kind of even want to go there. Nibbana is kind of, what is Nibbana anyway? Is it good? It's hard to kind of get a feeling for it. Okay, Nibbana is the end of all suffering, and it is the highest happiness. That is a very useful way of thinking about it, because that is essentially what the teachings are all about, of course. But the idea of Nibbana, the word itself, actually means extinguishment. So things are getting extinguished. What is that is getting extinguished? What first and foremost, what is getting extinguished is the defilements in the mind. Yeah, so this actually leads to more away, to more defilements. It leads, and part of it also is the fire that comes with those defilements. So you move in that direction, more defilements, more problems, more kind of less. More burdens, more things happening. instead of things getting extinguished, you're lighting more fires, yeah, creating more problems, more heat, and all of this kind of stuff. Nibbana is very beautiful. One way of thinking about Nibbana is to think, when you have a bit of success in your meditation practice, yeah, meditation is going well, and you feel peaceful, that is the degree of Nibbana, because things have been extinguished. That's why you're feeling peaceful. So things have been extinguished, not so many desires, less ill will, the body is starting to disappear, and all of that. That is how, that's kind of preliminary Nibbana, very small Nibbana, right? Tiny Nibbana. Then we kind of expand the Nibbana. The further down the path you go, the more kind of Nibbana you are experiencing. And there is actually sutras that explain it precisely in this way. Is that when you enter the jhanas or deep samadhi states, that is Nibbana, preliminary Nibbana, they call that. It's kind of a taste of Nibbana, because so much has disappeared, so much has been extinguished. So you could say, even when you're a little bit peaceful, tiny, 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 very small Nibbana, as you start out. Yeah? So this is a nice way of thinking about it, because it kind of gives you a feeling for what these things are. It gives you a positive perception of Nibbana, positive perception of non-self. Sometimes these things seem so frightening, but it's only because we don't misunderstand them. Once you kind of put them in context and perspective, actually, they become very powerful and beautiful. Yeah. So, he says, so all of this is what he does, and then as he does that, it subsides in him. And then this very last sentence here, right? Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, I removed it, I did away with it. And sometimes some of these words, the Pali words behind us, are very forceful words. Sometimes they are translated as obliterated, right? When you obliterate something, you get the sense of being very forceful. You obliterate, you exterminate it, you make it, cause it to cease to exist, and that kind of stuff. And this is very interesting, because these words, because they signify, or they seem to signify, a lot of willpower, a lot of agency, a lot of force, and all of these kind of things, that's what they seem to signify. Other places in the suttas, exactly these words are used again in how to deal with problems in the mind. It is very interesting that here, even though they seem to signify all this force, all this agency, all this doing, actually, what we have just seen, what they actually refer to, is using wisdom. Yeah, and this shows us how careful we have to be sometimes in interpreting the suttas, not getting it the wrong way around. When we see these words, we can assume that the main purpose of them is actually the use of wisdom rather than the use of willpower. There are also cases when you have to use a little bit of willpower. It's not entirely wrong, always. But in the vast majority of cases, if at all possible, we should use wisdom rather than using willpower. And it makes it so easy. Yeah, all you do is think in the right way. And if you do think in the right way, bam, the problem is gone straight away. The hardest part with wisdom is to be able to build up that perception that there actually is a problem. So, for example, with ill will, we're going to have a look at ill will in a second, but ill will is much easier because we know that ill will is so problematic. You know it causes all kinds of ruptures in our relationships. You know how unpleasant it can be to be around other people who have a lot of ill will. You know the problems with that, so it's quite easy to see. So you can start with ill will and build up that perception. I like this idea in Buddhism of building up various perceptions, and you have a little shelf, right? You have a shelf in your mind, and on that shelf you have kind of different perceptions, right? One has anti-ill will perception, one has kind of anti-sensual desire perception, one has metta perception, one has compassion. And you have all this perception, one has marana-sanya, the perception of death, right? And then when you need one of these perceptions as an antidote in your practice, you go to that shelf, you pull it down, because you have already built up this thing inside your mind that allows you to bring that out when it is required. But it takes work, it takes reflection, and this is kind of, so reflection actually is a significant part of the Buddhist path. Read the suttas, understand what they mean, reflect on them. The Buddha always talks about reflecting on the suttas after you have read them, not just kind of say, yeah, yeah, I understand, and kind of walk on and do something else. Otherwise, never going to sink in, really. And so this is what then when these perceptions have been built up in this way, they become very powerful. You use them, and what happens is that they actually do obliterate the opposite. They do obliterate these things that are problems in the mind. When you use wisdom, bam, it is completely gone. And because you have seen the opposite, it means that that thought cannot re-arise often for a long time afterwards. It is obliterated in a very kind of profound sense. It doesn't re-arise again. Now, if you compare this with willpower, if you are going to use willpower to kind of keep away a thought of ill will, you kind of say, oh, don't go away, bad thought, right? And you kind of suppress it in your mind. This is how the vast majority of people do deal with ill will and problems. Yeah, the ill will happens in daily life. You know this is a bad thought. If I kind of follow along here, it's going to lead to problems. I've got to suppress it. You kind of push it aside, right? This is the standard way of dealing with thoughts. But the problem with that is that if you hold it down like that, then there's two problems with that. The first one is incredibly tiring. After a while, it can be completely exhausted, and you can't hold it. You can't kind of keep it going anymore. Because you can't keep it going, it means that it comes up again. Yeah, so it's very exhausting and very tiring. And this is why one of the main difficulties in meditation practice is to avoid using too much willpower, because the willpower tires out the mind. After a while, you will become tired, you will fall asleep, or you will become restless because the mind doesn't want to do it anymore, and then meditation becomes impossible. This is why willpower is actually a problem in meditation. You want to do the opposite. You want to still the mind. That is where the energy comes from. That is only one problem. The second problem is, which is even worse, is the fact that if you use willpower to hold something down, as soon as you let go, bang, it comes back again. Yeah, because you haven't dealt with the underlying causes. You haven't dealt with the underlying problem, which is a wrong kind of perception, a wrong way of looking at things. Because you haven't dealt with the underlying issues, bam, it comes back and it hits you in the face. And you have the same problem as you had before. So this is kind of a distinction here. Wisdom, if you use wisdom wisely, right? Wisdom should always be used wisely. Don't you? Kind of makes sense, right? It would be terrible to use wisdom foolishly. That would be kind of a... I'm not sure that's possible. So you use wisdom, and when you do that, it's relatively easy. Not much willpower is actually required. All that is required is a small change in perception. Look in a different way. Yeah, and the second thing, if you use it properly, it eliminates the problem, and it is gone for a substantial amount of time afterwards, depending on how deep wisdom actually is. Yeah, so this is why we try to use wisdom as far as possible. Of course, there are cases when you have to restrain yourself, right? When you have a knife in your hand and you're about to kill somebody. Yeah, okay, stop, please. Okay, willpower, stop yourself. When you know that you're kind of heading somewhere really bad, doing something really dodgy, that sometimes it is appropriate to use willpower to hold yourself back. But as far as possible, we try to use wisdom power to overcome these things. Okay, so I hope that makes sense to you. If not, please try some questions again this evening. So now let us have a look at the other two kinds of bad thoughts. So it's the same thing again for these other kinds of bad thought. And the Buddha says, as I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and with effort, the thought of ill will arose in me, the thought of harming, or a thought of cold-heartedness, perhaps, or whatever, arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of harming has arisen in me, this thought of ruthlessness has arisen in me. It leads to my own affliction, to the affliction of others, to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nirvana. When I considered thus, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of ill will or a thought of harming arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. So exactly the same idea again, right? You know, and these two are much more important, especially ill will. Ill will is the one that really matters. So you know the problems with ill will. You know the kind of a negative mindset it encourages. You know that if you keep on following the ill will, it will tend to get worse. That is the problem with this mind state. It tends to get worse unless we deal with them in one way or another. So you deal with them to the maximum of your ability to avoid making all kind of stupid karma, to avoid the bad habits. So one of the things of the mind is that we run on habits. You will see this in a second. And because we run on habits, it's often difficult to change. Habits are hard to change, almost by definition, because they're habits. So sometimes you have to rebel against your own habits. So this is kind of one of those nice kind of rebellions. I don't want to follow these habits anymore. And you rebel against them. Because you know, if you don't deal with those habits now, they're going to be with you into the future, into the next life, and down the track. And that's going to cause you enormous problems as a consequence. So remember the problems with ill will. There are very serious problems with ill will, leading to lots of suffering in the world, leading to wars, conflict, disharmony, and eventually leading to a bad rebirth in a future life, unless you keep it in check, at least to some extent. So, now let us move on. And now we have a simile. I'm going to skip one paragraph and then come back to the other paragraph afterwards. And the simile goes as, this is a simile, by the way, right? Somebody was asking us that, this is a simile. This is kind of gives you a picture of what we've just been talking about. So, just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if he let those cows stray into the crops. So too, I saw in unwholesome qualities danger, degradation, and defilement. And in wholesome qualities, the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. This gives you a simile that explains roughly what is going on here. So the idea here is the cows are like the mind, right? You have to kind of look after your mind a bit like you look after cows. I'm not sure if that is good or bad. It sounds a little bit kind of, is your mind like a cow? Yeah. Okay, maybe it probably is, right? Cows kind of, they kind of go, kind of they do things in a fairly kind of predictable way, that don't have too much individuality or personality. Yeah, they kind of do things this way, that way. And I think we are a bit like that as well, the idea of non-self. We tend to run on programs, run on habits, we feel very individual, we feel very, I do my own stuff, but actually the reality, unfortunately, is quite different from that. Yeah. So it's a nice metaphor, the idea of the mind being like a cow, I quite like that. Yeah. So you tap and poke those cows, right? So they don't go into the crops. In the same way, we tap the mind a little bit. We say, okay, if you go there, that's going to cause suffering. So come back this way here. Go too far outside? Okay, come back this way again here. So you tap and poke the mind a little bit to make sure it doesn't go into the crops. The crops is the ill will. The crops is the sensual desire. That's what the crops is in this simile here. Why is that? Because you see that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, and blamed. He would be, suffering ensues if you allow the mind to go in the wrong place. And exactly the same thing with his cows. And then he says, so too, I saw in this unwholesome quality, danger, right? Adinava, danger in Pali. It's a nice word. Degradation. This is kind of, interesting. Degradation, the Pali word is okara. Okara literally means to make low. So you make something low, you degrade it, you kind of bring it down. Yeah, so it's like when you have strong defilements, you kind of feel lower. Yeah, if your mind is very pure and you feel a lot of metta and compassion and kindness to people around you, you kind of feel elevated. I'm sure you know what I mean. You feel elevated. You feel like more of a true person, more of a pure person, more like a deva, if you like. Yeah? You have all those light and beautiful, bright qualities. But if your mind is full of this kind of, this other stuff, which is kind of dirty and solid with ill will and all these negative things, you actually feel that. It brings you down. It degrades you. You feel less of a human being. You feel less of the ideal human being anyway. Of course, everything is human being, but of the ideal and the high quality human being. So, you know, that's kind of a useful way of thinking of it, because being degraded is not a very nice state to be in. And then defilement is a very similar idea. Defiled in Pali just means that it is dirty, right? It is has spots on it, this kind of stuff. In the wholesome qualities, you have the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing, cleaning up your mind, getting out the Buddha's washing powder, and making sure that kind of you are bright, bright and pure inside. There you are. The blessing of renunciation, right? It's kind of nice. Most people think of renunciation as something terrible. But actually, in the sutta, according to the way of the Buddha, it's the blessing of renouncing things. And of course, renunciation here refers again to this idea of abandoning the attachment, mostly, to sensual, the sensual world. And then we go back one passage, and the Buddha says, bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu, a bhikkhuni, a layperson, anyone in the entire world frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of sensual desire, they have abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then their mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of sense of ill will, of harming, they have abandoned the thought of non-harming to cultivate the thought of harming, and then their mind inclines to thoughts of harming. So this makes this point about how we are creatures of habits. We come into this world, and when we come into this world, we already have a lot of pre-existing habits and things that we carry with us. We see how people are so different, yeah? How our mental habits are so different. Some are habitually angry, some are habitually very friendly, some are habitually lots of desires, some are very jealous by nature. All of these things are kind of part and parcel of being human beings. And we kind of often carry those personality traits with us throughout life. Have you noticed that how people tend to have certain personality traits? And we kind of carry with them throughout our life. This is so common. It is so incredibly common. Why is that? Well, it is precisely because habits, unless we actually actively do something against them, they just carry on by themselves. That is the nature of habits. That's the nature of personality. These are embedded inside of us. So remember that. This is actually very important, right? Because it means that we tend to progress in a certain way because of existing habits. And sometimes if we don't do anything about it, either they stay the same, or sometimes they get worse. Because things in the world often tend to get worse unless you do something to check them and to kind of hold them back, in a sense. And this has many consequences. One of the consequences of this is that when you see other people and we ask other people to change, yeah, it's so common in life that we have family members, we don't quite fully see eye to eye with them and we'd like them to change and be different. Please don't ask other people to change, because change is actually very difficult. Look into your own life and see how easy it is to abandon your own bad qualities. How easy is it to abandon your own ill will, abandon your own desires? Actually, it is really hard. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of wisdom, and to move your mind in the right way. It's actually, you read the suttas and you do this and you keep on going on for a decade. And still you have only perhaps done a little bit, yeah? And you keep on going. So when we understand how hard it is to change our own habits, we never actually ask anyone else in our life to change their habits. Because it's actually so difficult. Instead what we do is we accept them for what they are, because we know that these kind of demands are really crazy and it's never actually going to go anywhere. This is one of the insights you get from this. The other insight is that you understand how important it is to try to change course. Because if you don't change course, these habits will be carried on into the future. Now we have the opportunity, right? Now you have these great teachings here. You have the word of the Buddha to advise you. You have people in the world who still practice these teachings well. Now you have the opportunity. You don't know when that opportunity will arise again in the future. Now is the opportunity. If you don't do anything now, it will continue on in the future. This is one of those insights that people have who have, I've heard some stories of people, these are some lay people who had some past life regressions, and they claimed, I'll maybe talk a bit more about this later on, but he claimed that this was such a powerful past life regression, and all the facts kind of fit it in with the fact that he could discover also in past records and all these kind of things. So this person was absolutely convinced that he had seen a past life of his. Even though he didn't believe in past lives before, once he had seen this, he was forced to change his mind about that. But the most scary thing, he said, was how he could see how his personal character traits kept on coming, right, from one life to the next one, and moving on in this way. And he said he was very scared because he had thought that he was an independent agent in his life. He always thought, I'm doing this because I want to do these things. And suddenly he realized that that wasn't the case at all. He was just running on the program that had been written in the past. A bit like a robot, a bit like a computer, trapped in his own personality, not really understanding that it was a trap, thinking that he had free will, thinking that he was choosing on his own accord. That is kind of scary when you see that. It's kind of concerning because you know that you start to understand how we are trapped in this whole thing and how difficult it can be to get out of this. So what we do then, once you realize that, you start to change the way you think. And as you do that, this train, right, steam train, hurtling down the tracks, 200 kilometers an hour, lots of momentum. And this is kind of our habits. And gradually you change direction, very, very slowly. A train, which is very heavy, which weighs hundreds of tons or whatever it is, takes a long time to change direction and move around. But slowly, as you change your habit, you can see things changing. And of course, the beauty of this is that if your habits previously were to have a lot of ill will and a lot of negativity in your mind, and then you change. As you change, you can feel that your habits become different. And when your habits are different, that ill will doesn't arise anymore. It can't really arise anymore. Now, the habit is to be kind. So whenever you kind of settle back and you sit down and you close your eyes in your meditation, instead of feeling ill will, the natural thought is kindness arises in you. So the baseline, instead of the baseline being something negative, the baseline is something positive. You still have ill will every now and again, because that's unavoidable. But when you come back to kind of sitting down, doing your meditation, you come back to the to kind of your habits, if you like it. Those habits have now become positive, and you have changed. And you can see that in your life. You know, you deal with certain individuals you would find very hard to deal with, and then you kind of learn to think about them in a different way. And I'm going to talk about this more tomorrow or something, maybe this afternoon, actually. We'll see what happens. And suddenly you think about people who were difficult before in a completely different way. The ill will is gone. The negativity is gone. It's like almost like a small miracle. And it's very useful to see that change inside of you, see how it happens, because it reminds you of how powerful this path actually is when you practice it in the right way. And suddenly it's easy to be kind, easy to do the right thing, whereas before it was hard to be kind, hard to do the right thing. So it is very, once the habits change, once your entire mental makeup changes, everything tends to fall into place. You think in the right way. When you think in the right way, right actions, right speech happen as a consequence. And the whole path tends to fall into place. Things become easy. It was difficult before, but now everything is so much easier. This is what the Buddha means here by this habit patterns of ours. As we change our habit patterns, that is where a lot of the work kind of is in terms of what we have to do with the way of thinking and these kind of things. There you are. I hope I haven't kind of made it sound too hard. It actually isn't that hard. This is kind of the interesting thing about this. It's not that it is hard. It's just that it needs perseverance and practice. So what is the point of what I have been saying now? So the point is that the main point I've been trying to bring out is that the mind can be divided into bad qualities and good qualities. This is number one. And then to overcome the bad qualities, the most powerful way and by far the best way of doing that is to use wisdom rather than willpower. That is by far the best way. And as we do that, you continue doing that, you're changing your habits, you're heading in a new direction, and then the path kind of tends to fall into place as a consequence. That is a very brief summary for you of what I've just been talking about. Okay, so that is all. for now. So we'll see you again. Continue the sutta at 3 o'clock this afternoon.